From the BBC in London, this is Brian Matthew introducing The Beatles Story. It's December 1967. The sad passing of Brian Epstein has left the Beatles temporarily going in several different directions at once. George has become increasingly interested in Indian music, whilst John and Ringo have each been involved in solo film acting. Together, the Beatles have made Magical Mystery Tour, which is about to have its premiere on TV. The Apple Company is expanding. Part 9, Meditation and Corporation.
Well, you see, it's about a group of Covent Garden strange people on a coach tour around anywhere, really. And things happen to them, you see. Something got gobbly, diddly, 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 magical mystery tour. And there's a little scene.
Magical Mystery Tour, the Beatles' own film, conceived by Paul, who was not too happy about the way the critics received it after its television premiere on Boxing Day 1967.
The thing is, see, at the time, I'll tell you what was... There's a couple of main things that were really hashed up about that. One was that it was in... We made it in colour, you know, it was a sort of colour thing, and it was put out, first of all, in black and white, so there's whole big sequences that... And you couldn't understand, you know, because they looked... I saw it on the telly and it just looked mad, you know, in black and white, because there were sequences where the colours changed, you know, and, you know, so, I mean, that was a bit daft. The thing itself was we just did it off our own bat, you know, and I think it was put on, like, the wrong time on telly when everyone's expecting sort of Christmas extravaganzas, and we put on this mad film. But I've since seen it, you know, and a lot of people have since seen it, and, like, for instance, been around America since... And it's being very successful at the moment, you know, because it's now people are sort of catching up with what it's about now, you know. And so it's now beginning to be very, very successful. It wasn't on the day it was out. You know, the first day it was out in Britain, there was a lot of comment about it. But it, as I say, you know, it's been shown in America and it's been shown in a lot of places since. And now it's getting very successful. I tell you, I think it's going to be in about 10 years' time, it's going to be one of those films that said, yeah, let's have a look at that again. And it'll be like an old, you know, sort of like a Rock Around the Clock in them. You know, now they look better than they did then. Because they get some nostalgia and stuff. At the time, it was just a bit sudden and it was a bit sort of too great. But I still like it as a thing. I still think it's great.
And if it was ahead of its time visually, musically, it was right on. One song that Paul wrote and sang, The Fool on the Hill, became a pop standard covered by a number of singers.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
Now that was Paul, and here's Pet Clark's version.
On his way, his head in a cloud, the man with a thousand voices talking perfectly loud. Nobody ever hears him or the songs he appears to make, and he never seems to notice. But the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
And following Pet, a different treatment by Sergio Mendez. We finished up once again with Paul. Also in that film, I Am the Walrus, which had been released earlier on the B-side of Hello, Goodbye. Kenny Everett asked John Lennon about their recording technique for the strange effects in that song.
Now, notice on this one, there's a hell of a lot of editing. A heck of a lot of editing.
What? On Walrus?
On Walrus, yeah. There's all voices and things in.
Yeah, that's not editing. See, we did that on the remix. So we had, like, that track you were there for, and the electric piano and drums and things. Then we put the bass on separate. And then we put the musicians on. And then when we were remixing, we had all the voices, which we just brought in. As we were doing it, sort of a bit ad-lib, you know. So it's not editing at all. It was just all going on.
Yeah.
It was like we did the loops like that. So they're all going on all the time. You just bring them in now and then.
And who works the controls then?
About 10 of us, you know, whoever's... It's just sort of old people with hands on it. Me, Paul, anybody that's around, you know.
Tuesday man, you've been a naughty boy, you let your face go wrong. I am the egg.
I Am the Walrus, very much in the same musical bag as the earlier Strawberry Fields Forever, and a very obvious John composition. By this time, it was quite easy to see who was writing what and pick out the difference between the Lennon and McCartney styles. The flower power era almost over, George flew off to Bombay to work on this soundtrack music for the film Wonderwall. John, too, left the country, this time for Morocco, where he took a short holiday in the sun. Kenny Everett caught up with John on his return whilst recording the Beatles' next album, and the conversation went like this.
When I was a little baby, my mama used to smash me in the cradle, picking those old cotton fields back home.
Cotton
fields. When Mama was a little bitty baby, she used to smash me in my cradle. When I was a little bitty baby, back home.
That was impresario John Lennon playing for you. And now, a few words from him.
And there goes some daddy story out to a child. What's the matter, Kenny Everett, MBE.
A photograph of you in the Daily Mirror, standing in a sheet. You look very peaceful.
That's called a burnous, Kenny, and I got it from Morocco.
Really?
Standing in a sheet, what do you mean?
It looked like a sheet.
Well, they do. Burnouses look very, very like sheets.
Mm-hmm.
See, so as the lower classes in Morocco don't feel too put out.
Yeah.
Having only with sheets to wear.
I'd have black ones if I had them. Wouldn't show us.
Very hot, though. Very hot, Ken. Black clothes.
Is that mine?
Very hot indeed.
Have you got anything to say that our listeners would understand?
How about good morning?
About anything you've recorded so far. Something that they'll comprehend.
No, we've just done two tracks, both unfinished. And the second one's Ringo's first song that we're working on this very moment.
Exactly. He composed it himself?
He composed it himself in a fit of lethargy.
And what do you think about it?
I think it's the most wonderful thing I've ever heard since Niels's River Deep and Mountain Dew.
I listen for your footsteps coming up the drive. Listen for your footsteps, but they don't arrive. Waiting for your knock, dear, on my old front door. I don't hear it. Does it mean you don't love me anymore? I hear the clock ticking on the mantelshelf. See the hands are moving, but I'm by myself. I wonder where you are tonight, and why I'm by myself. I don't see you. Does it mean you don't love me anymore? Don't pass me by, don't make me cry, don't make me blue. So unfair. You were in a car crash and you lost your hair. You said that you would be late about an hour or two. Was it? That's alright, I'm waiting here, just waiting to hear from you. Don't pass me by, don't make me cry, don't make me blue. 'Cause you know, darling,
in February 1968, the four Beatles set off together on their travels abroad. However, this time, there was a difference. They were not going to work, but to study meditation under the Maharishi at his academy in Rishikesh, India. John and George stayed for nearly 3 months, but Ringo came home after 2 weeks, and Paul and Jane Asher, who'd become engaged at Christmas, stayed only a little while longer. On their return, Paul and Jane spoke to BBC reporter Richard Whitmore about the experience. He asked them, first of all, what exactly meditation was, what they did.
You sit down, you relax, and then you repeat a sound to yourself. And it sounds daft, but it's just a system of relaxation. And that's all it is, you know, there's nothing more to it. So that we meditated for about 5 hours a day in all, you know, sort of 2 hours in the morning and maybe 3 hours in the evening. And then the rest of the time we slept, ate, sunbathed, and had fun, you know.
One Indian MP accused this place of being an espionage centre. of being a spy for the West.
Don't tell anyone. It's true.
It is.
We're spies, yes. The four of us have been spies. Actually, I'm a reporter, and I joined the Beatles for that very reason. But story's out next week in the paper, which will be nameless.
Jane, did you go for a holiday, or did you go to meditate as well?
Oh, to meditate, yes.
And what effect has it had on you? This presumably is your first big meditation.
I think it calms you down. It's hard to tell because it was so different life out there. It'll be easier to tell now that I'm back and we're doing sort of ordinary things to see just what it does.
Lady Madonna, the Beatles single, issued on March the 15th. The old magic still worked because that too went to number one a week later. Round about this time, the Beatles started to expand the Apple idea. Derek Taylor, their former press officer, explains it.
It was to run a brand new company in a brand new way and have some fun and hire your friends and make some money, sell some records, and some clothes by the fool and so on, make some inventions. The original idea that was put to me was that they would buy an estate, and we would all live on it. There'd be a big dome in the middle, which would be Apple, and then there'd be four corridors leading to four large houses, one for John, Paul, George and Ringo, and around the estate there'd be other houses, the sort of the gardener's domes, and we'd live in there. And one way and another, a good time would be had by all. Well, the reality was that they didn't buy an estate because, land being what it is, the nearest place you could get was Norwich, which nobody could see us running a record company out of Norwich, crazy though we were, and still are, some of us. So, I guess you settled for compromises, and we ended up in a big 18th century house in Savile Row, number 3, which became known as Apple.
Later on the other side of the world in Hollywood, Paul attended the Capitol Records sales convention, and the announcement was made that in future, the Beatles' own records would not be released on Parlophone, but on their own Apple label. The first record on Apple, issued on August the 30th, was this one.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid.
It certainly was the longest single that had been made up to that time. And also, I think it was the only time we've had such a long fade out. You know, it was sort of, I think the fade took about 3 minutes. It was obviously a Paul song, and we actually recorded it with Paul sitting at the piano singing as he played. And then we overdubbed this fairly large orchestra. And we got about 40 musicians in the studio playing their instruments. And somewhat reluctantly, we also got them singing on the end. Because we wanted a kind of general big noise. And I didn't really like doing it very much. In fact, one of them asked me for a special fee afterwards, which I think he got.
Really?
But it worked out, I think, as a very satisfactory record. And in fact, of course, it was one of the biggest single sellers they've ever had. I think that record alone sold about 4.5 million copies.
George Martin. In complete contrast to that production, an animated cartoon film was issued that summer with music by the Beatles and George Martin, all based on this tune.
In the town where I was born lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life in the land of submarines. So we sailed on to the sun till we found a sea of green, and we lived beneath the waves in our yellow submarine. Yellow submarine, we all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. And our friends are all aboard, many more of them live next door, and the band begins to play. Yellow submarine, we all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. All we need, sky of blue, and sea of green, in our yellow submarine.
We all live in a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine.
Ringo's Yellow Submarine, first recorded in 1966, which incidentally also inspired a discotheque in one of the newer hotels in London's West End. Tony Bramwell, Apple promotion manager at that time.
In the autumn of 68, John's relationship with Yoko had got much stronger, and he did get divorced from Cynthia. His controversial Two Virgins album was released. The sleeve of it featured John and Yoko naked, taken in their flat, which was in Montague Square. John really wasn't too good with cameras, and I set the camera up and the lighting and the delayed action, and then left it up to them to take the photograph, which was printed secretly by a well-known newspaper.
In addition to that, the Beatles' authorised biography was published.
I take two.
Okay.
Tears.
Revolution One from the White Double album. George Harrison.
I think in a way it was a mistake doing four sides, because first of all it's too big for people to really get into it, for reviewers and also the public. Maybe now people who've bought it, and if they've really listened to it for years or since it was out, then they, you know, they'll have their own favourites. And there's a couple of things that we could have done without on the album, and maybe if we'd have made it just compact, 14 songs, say. There was all different types of music and types of songs, and there was nothing really shocking about it. I don't think there was anything particularly poor about it, but it was a bit heavy, you know. I find it heavy to listen to myself. In fact, I don't listen to it myself. I listen to mainly side one, which I like very much, with, you know, Glass Onion and what else? Glass Onion, Warm Gun, yeah.
I told you about strawberry fields. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go, where everything flows.
Glass Onion. A Canadian journalist, Richie York, then asked George how he wrote While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
I wrote it at my mother's house in the north of England.
Oh, yeah.
I just had my guitar, and I think I just opened... That's right, I just wanted to write a song. And I do this often, actually. If I haven't got particularly an idea for a song, then I believe in a bit like I Ching, you know, where it's everything is... at that moment is relative to that situation. So with When My Guitar Gently Weeps, I think, was typical of that. I just opened a book that was around. I just opened it, and the first thing I looked at became the song, and it was something about gently weeps. And then from that, the whole thought started going, and I just wrote the song then, just closed the book again, and I had the idea. Yeah, I like that. We did it... I think, you know, Eric Clapton played guitar on that. Right. I think some people wrote letters to me saying, you've got a really good blues feel where you play that guitar. And we didn't publicize it, but we didn't, like, keep it a secret.
No.
Eric's sort of a good friend of mine, and I really dig him as a guitarist and as a guy.
Love that's sleeping.
guitar gently weeps. Look at the floor, and I see it needs sweeping. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told me. Someone controlled you. They bought and sold you. I look at the world and I notice it's turning. While my guitar gently weeps. Surely be learning. Still my guitar gently weeps.
As it happened with Sgt. Pepper, there was one track on this LP which caused problems and led to all sorts of rumours about Paul being dead. Most of them centred around the song Revolution Number 9. Number 9.
Number 9.
Number 9.
Number 9. Number 9. Number 9. Number 9. Number 9. Number 9. Number 9.
Most of the trouble arose when the end of this track was copied to tape and played backwards. An American reporter claims to have heard a car screeching, a crash, a crowd in panic, a chorus singing hallelujah, the sound of burning, a person over the top saying, "Turn me on, dead man," and a man yelling, "Help, get me out of here." We tried the experiment, and quite frankly, it struck us as so far-fetched as not to be worth consideration. As George Martin, the producer, says...
A rumour started that Paul had died some while back, and this gained tremendous strength for some odd reason, and whispers got around, and people lent support to it. And I was continually being asked if he was alive and so on. A lot of things added up. People, in fact, I started getting letters from people outlining how obvious it was that Paul was dead. You know, I began to believe it myself. The fact that on Pepper, on the back, he was the only one of the four of them to be not facing the camera. His back was turned to the camera. And he also, in the front of the cover, he was wearing a black buttonhole and everybody was wearing a white or a red one. Little things like that, people were sort of reading and saying, oh, well, it's obvious that he's died and the boys are covering it up. Well, if he was dead, he had a jolly good impersonator working for him because, you know, this actually happened one afternoon when Paul was around at my place playing the piano and we were having tea. And we had a big laugh about it. But it wasn't so much of a laugh when you were woken at 3 a.m. from some little girl in Wisconsin saying, please, can you tell me if Paul really is alive? Don't say he's dead. Please don't say he's dead.
And a last word from John.
All those things are beyond me, you know. I believe that any, like, with this packet, you can read something into that if you want, and nobody sees the same picture. And you can, all lyrics mean everything people want, but there was never any specific Turn Me On Dead Man or the other famous one that I won't repeat, that where you played it backward and got a secret message. Our things are pretty straightforward. What it says, it means just about what it says. If it's imagery, it's imagery. If it's straight lyrics, it's straight lyrics, you know.
Or was it cranberry sauce? In part 10 of the Beatles story, we'll find out about their new full-length feature film, how they appoint a new business advisor, and make another great album. The Beatles Story was written and produced for the BBC by Johnny Beerley.